I'm happy to tell you that this small, lovely white church will be well represented in the nation's capital in the next few days. Our choir director, Bob Scott, is in Washington today to present a Christmas tree to Hillary Clinton and guests tomorrow. And a couple of days after Christmas, Cindy Carnahan's singing group, The Spirit of Christmas, will sing for assembled guests in the White House. I thought you might like to know that the miracle on 29th Street is spreading its talent around. It was on an unsigned postcard in response to an invitation I made several weeks ago for sermon topics from the congregation. It said, poignantly, I thought, "I am by myself, and I do such simple, routine things that I often get depressed, thinking my life doesn't count. Can you convince me that it does?" Well, I'm not sure I can, but I am convinced of the power of unheralded individual lives. And I believe that a good life, even a great life, is built out of a host of little things that seem unimportant at the time. Here are some thoughts in response to that question. Some years ago, I read about a man who found on Long's Peak in Colorado a fallen giant of a tree whose rings showed it had survived for more than 400 years, which means it was just a seedling when Columbus landed at San Salvador in the Bahamas in 1492. It had been struck 14 times by lightning and survived. For over four centuries, it had withstood avalanches of snow and ice, winter storms, and summer drought. It finally fell because it could not withstand an attack of beetles, each one smaller than the head of a match. In a country where millions think big is better, I read that story as a parable from nature to remind us of the power of little things. I remember watching the Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter political debate one night when it was interrupted for almost half an hour by a technical failure no one could locate. The next evening on national news, I saw the tiny transistor which caused that monumental gaffe. It was almost swallowed up in David Brinkley's hand, but it had humiliated three great networks, forced the president of the most powerful country on earth to stand waiting, and interrupted the speech of another man who, although he did not know it at the time, would soon become the next president. Another reminder of the power there can be in something that looks small and insignificant. I remember driving in a Winnebago RV one summer through the back roads logging country of Oregon when all of a sudden, without even a second's warning, the motor died and everything stopped working. We were towed in to a rural gas station where no one could figure it out until somebody said, "We need Shorty." And Shorty turned out to be a legendary mechanic in those parts. So they went out 10 miles deeper into the woods and brought him back. Shorty lifted the hood, tore into the engine like a man possessed, took stuff apart, bared a jungle of wires, tossed things cavalierly right and left until I thought, this trip is over. There's no way this guy can find the problem or even put all this stuff back together. But he did find the problem. One wire, deep, deep inside that engine, and not as thick as a matchstick, but when it shorted out, that big old RV and the seven of us on vacation were left completely helpless. Little things. Sometimes they are the termites that destroy the house of our hopes. Sometimes they are the tiny building blocks that make life good. In that great library of human experience we call the Bible, it was inevitable that someone would do a little homily on things that appear trivial. Listen to this paragraph from Proverbs, written by some long since forgotten teacher named Agur, who watched keenly the world around him and found all sorts of practical lessons in it for his students. Don't look for it to be profound, because it isn't. But he probably knew that we have to be reminded often of truth that seems simple and obvious. You will notice that he makes his observations as an amateur biologist and leaves you to locate the moral lesson. Take a look at ants, he says. They are weak, but they store up their food in the summer. And the little rock rabbits, they are not strong either and have no defenses, but they make their home in the rocks. Consider those swarms of locusts that plague us from time to time. They have no king, yet they travel in good order. And scampering lizards, so small you can hold one in your hand, yet you find them in the palaces of kings. Unlike many of us, he was not much impressed by mere size. He had no way of knowing about the dinosaurs, those ponderous nightmares that moved dully through the Mesozoic, because long before he lived, they had vanished, unable, despite all their tonnage, to survive in a changing world. But the four little creatures he names, all small enough to be held in his hand, had made it. And to him, they had miniature sermons to preach. The ants are a people not strong, but they store up food in summer. He calls them a people because he has noticed that they live in a community that seems organized. But what really impresses him is their foresight. They have a sense of tomorrow. He knew people who didn't. I had a friend once in Wichita who, during his bachelor years, was a counselor in a children's home. One evening, he found a boy about 15 years old trying to sleep under a bridge in Riverside Park. He offered to share his own little house, not far from where I lived. And for about a year on our walks around the river, I was kept up to date on how this exercise in compassion was going. The most serious problem was that the teenage boy had no faith at all in tomorrow. He lived only for today. Nothing else was real to him. To be told that he might have something next month was like being told he could never have it. When he had to wait for something he wanted very much, he would fall on the floor, kick his feet, beat his fists, and cry like a child in a tantrum. My friend understood this because his work had exposed him before to that personality disorder. The boy had been switched from one foster home to another until he had lost faith in tomorrows. If you didn't get it now, you didn't get it. One day, because he wanted something right then, he stole my friend's car and clothing and took off for California. True to form, he had so little sense of what might happen next that he made no plans even to avoid arrest, and he was caught somewhere in eastern New Mexico. I grant that he was a classic case of living only for the moment, but some of us still, and most of us when we are young, have a hard time believing that next month or next year will ever come. So when someone begs us to use today wisely, to train ourselves for a productive tomorrow, we see no point in that advice. Springtime is only for picking flowers. It has nothing to do with planting seeds for harvest against the winter. So over and over, with deep distress when we love them, we watch certain young people waste their short and wondrous spring. They really mean to do something by way of preparation, they tell us. They are thinking about it, but while they wait and consider, the first leaves are touched with red and gold, and one morning the grass is white with frost, and it's too late. The moment for getting ready to be what they hoped to be passes, and they are trapped forever where they are. As another writer of Proverbs says in that collection, they have ignored the parable of the ant. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, his poetic manual says, and the things you might have done are no longer possible. So he concludes, sow your seed in the morning of life. We call it apprenticeship. We call it making the most of school. We call it the ability to trust tomorrow if you use today right. If this ancient naturalist saw the ant as a parable of when to do things, I suppose he saw the rock rabbit or marmot as a parable of sensible self-protection. The little Syrian coney has no horns or tusks or claws with which to defend itself or dig a den, so it has to find a hole in the rocks. It had discovered where, in critical times, there is security. So watching it, it had apparently occurred to our proverb maker that some of his neighbors had never bothered to locate security. As for the locusts, those pests of ancient life, he learned from them a lesson in mutuality and cooperation. They had no king to make policy, but they move, he said, like some vast army under orders. Miniature proofs that no matter how small or weak we are, in league with others and moved by some profound purpose, we can be irresistible. And finally, the lizard. so small he could lift it in his hand, and yet he had seen it skittering across the floor in palaces of great kings where bigger and stronger creatures could not enter. This is his parable of persistence, a humdrum power that forever surprises us. Some of my A students never did much, despite talent, frittering away their time, distracted by misplaced loyalties. Some of my poor students plowed doggedly up hills too high for them to climb until they stood finally above all of us. I have seen it happen many times. I realize that these are almost painfully simple nuggets of truth, not profound because the book of Proverbs is not, when you look at it closely, a profound book. It's an anthology of ordinary advice, the kind that used to hang on the wall in kitchens of farmhouses, but the kind that even in our sophistication, we may sometimes need to remember. A certain Jewish boy, centuries later, had learned the lesson of those proverbs. One who is faithful in a very little, he said, is faithful also in much. And one who is dishonest in a very little is dishonest in much. It sounds a little like Judge Roy Bean philosophizing in Larry McMurtry's The Streets of Laredo. A man who will steal 50 cents from you, the judge said, will steal anything you've got. Jesus understood that it does not take something big to measure character. He spoke of the cup of cold water, the one talent, the single lost coin, the world of promise in the heart and mind of a child. We manage to forget such things and to convince ourselves that only the large events shape life. A simple test of memory proves this is not true. Each one of us can remember something from childhood which no one else in the whole family can recall, because to them it was trifling, quickly forgotten. To us, forgive the overworked phrase, it was a defining moment. I once saw on our Channel 8 a little sermon in miniature which I thought must have touched a raw nerve in some parents who were watching it. It showed a father taking his son to a movie. The boy is clearly delighted to be with his dad, whom he idolizes. After they pay for their tickets, the boy says something about his age, which reveals to us that the father has lied to save a few pennies. With hero worship in his eyes, the boy looks up at his father and says, "Gee, Dad, you're smart. I hope I'm as smart as you are when I grow up." I wondered how many fathers, hearing that, wish they could undo a couple of moments when they underestimated the importance of something that seemed trifling. I got acquainted when I first came to Wichita with a taciturn old farmer west of town from whom I bought fresh eggs. As a friendship ripened between us, he opened up and began to ask me about my life and work. And when he heard the part about teaching, he admitted that he had no idea at all of what high school or college might be like. He was almost 80 then, But he remembered a crucial incident in his life as clearly as if it had happened the week before. Probably everyone else involved on that far-off day had long since forgotten it entirely. But for this old man, it had been a turning point in his life, and he had never forgotten. He had sat one day, he told me, in a little schoolhouse near college, between a boy and a girl who were passing notes. And as the note passed across his desk, the teacher saw it, blamed an innocent boy for it, refused to believe his embarrassed denial, and then paddled his hands in front of the whole class. As he told this story about a mere couple of minutes in his life, 65 or 70 years ago, the old man shook his head at me in remembered anger and humiliation and said, "I went back up there to that school the same night. I got my stuff out of my desk, and I never went back to school the rest of my life." The old farmer has been gone now for years, but I still remember how he looked when he told me that, and how a whole world that might have opened up for him closed forever because of something no one else that day would have thought important. "Anything happen at school today, Sally?" "Oh, Betty forgot her homework and John got spanked for passing notes. Nothing much." When my own children tell me of things that impressed them, that they never forgot, that entered deeply into the shaping of their minds and hearts, I'm almost always surprised by what some small act, some chance word, thought trivial at the time, may have for someone. You remember the postcard? "My life doesn't seem to count. Can you convince me that it does?" I've been trying, by reminders that some word or deed of yours that seems only trivial and routine may be more important to someone than you can possibly guess. If you're here this morning, or anyone else is listening who wonders, how big is one? How would I make any difference? Take this story with you when you leave. Imagine a long, smooth beach at Pacific Shores Resort on Vancouver Island. A man on vacation is walking that desolate beach by himself one cold gray morning when he sees another figure far in the distance. As they get closer, he recognizes a local native he had met a day or so before, who keeps leaning down, picking something up, and throwing it out into the ocean. As the distance between them continues to narrow, the man can see that the native is picking up starfish that had been washed up on the beach, and one at a time is throwing them back into the surf. Puzzled, the man walks up to the native, because he is a man who likes to talk to people, and asks what he's doing. "I'm throwing these starfish back in the ocean. You see, it's low tide right now, and all of these starfish have been washed up on the shore. If I don't throw them back, they'll die up here from lack of oxygen. But there must be thousands of starfish on this beach," the visitor says. "You can't possibly get to all of them. They're just too many. And this same thing is probably happening on dozens of beaches all up and down this coast. I don't want to seem cynical, but how can what you're doing possibly make any difference? The local smiled, bent down, picked up another starfish, and as he tossed it back into the sea, said, "Made a difference to that one." There is so much to be done, and we have such limits of money and time and energy that we feel when we leave, there will still be thousands of starfish stranded on the beach. So we give up and do nothing at all, since we can't do everything. Or, like that quixotic man on the Canadian beach, we decide to make a difference for the lives around us, one at a time. I can tell you that that can be a cure for depression. When I walk away this morning, will the Pilgrims and the Dixons please walk out so that they can be in Fellowship Hall to receive your warm welcome as new members of this church. And John Lottie, it's nice to have you down from KU. I will say to the Pilgrims that I told them out in the foyer I would resist the temptation to say how appropriate it was that Pilgrims would be joining a congregational church, but I didn't get to the KU student who said it for me. Will you bow your heads, please? Open our eyes, gracious God, to the importance of a small gift, a loving word, a moment of compassion in the routine of this week. We ask through Christ our Lord. Amen.